I've still not seen Master Dickens. But I saw his publisher just now, who says he might be calling himself Boz at the moment. So perhaps I've been asking after the wrong bloke. All right, then. Here we go. The little old woman then up she got, all in a fury, hot, hot, hot. Says she, such boys sure never were known. They never will leave an old woman alone. Now here is a moral if you follow my gist. If you mean to sell codlins, never get
pissed.
You are so rude.
Right on, itty, 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 right on, itty, itty, right on, lay.
Right then, back to my Regency pantomime clowning, full of vice and delicious naughtiness. The epitome of these mischievous times. What an irony, therefore, that I should have been elected chief judge and treasurer of the Court of Rectitude, a group of actors and pantomimists whose job it is to maintain and sanction the moral behaviour and conduct of the performers at Sadler's Wells. It's always been the theatre manager's task to maintain the professionalism of the company, but ours is to admonish and fine those found guilty of such grave misdemeanours as using profane language. 1 penny per offence. Or breaking wind. 1 penny for a first offence and 2 pence for each thereafter. As well as being given such weighty responsibilities, my popularity and fame also mean that I'm now known wherever I go, which is flattering indeed, but also the cause of some bizarre situations. I remember once when I happened to be playing both Sadler's Wells and Covent Garden on the same evening, and I had no time to change costume. I had to travel between the two at utmost speed, but the driver of my coach failed to appear, and I had no choice but to run through the streets. It was a dark night, so I got on pretty well at first, but when I came into the streets of Clerkenwell, where the lights of the shops showed a figure in clown's dress and makeup running along at full pelt, people began to take rather more notice. A man recognised me and shouted, "Hey, up here's Joe Grimaldi!" With the result that a few heads turned round to look, and then a few more and a few more after that. So to avoid further embarrassment, I set off faster than ever. But I was followed by a growing mob who were shouting and screaming out my name and throwing up their caps. I ran all the way to Holborn with several hundred people at my heels, and there I was lucky enough to find an empty coach. I jumped straight in and off we set. But they all simply charged alongside my carriage and escorted me to Covent Garden. I arrived surrounded by the dirtiest bodyguard that ever was beheld. They saw me into the theatre, then all rushed to the gallery doors in order to make an appearance in the auditorium just as I was entering onto the stage. And they greeted me with a boisterous parody of my own catchphrase, "Here he is again!" Mind you, it isn't just the ordinary hoi polloi who come to see me. Oh, no, no, no. Fashionable society come to see me regularly. The Lord Chancellor, Lord Eldon. Oh. Colonel William Barclay, oh. Sir Godfrey Webster, oh. And even the Duke of York come to see my pantomimes. Oh. Such lofty personages give the lie to the work of us pantomimists as being lowbrow. Lord Byron was a particular admirer, and we would chat for hours together at Covent Garden during shows. Then, when I was called upon the stage, he would wait in the wings, and as soon as I came off, recommenced the conversation where it had been interrupted. He even presented me with a silver snuff box as a token of his regard, and took a box ticket at every one of my benefit nights, for which I received a princely £5 note. Laziness and unprofessionalism are traits I cannot abide. There was an idle drunkard of a pantaloon we knew as Billy Coombs, who was given his comeuppance by me and the harlequin Mr. Davidge. Well, one evening, when the pantomime was in progress, Davidge pointed to a chest, which was used in the piece, and remarked that Billy was drunk again and would have to get into it shortly as part of the action. And would it not be a good joke to turn the key upon him? I readily agreed. And no sooner was Billy beneath the lid than he was locked in, amidst the plaudits of the audience, who thought it a capital trick. There were only two more scenes left in the pantomime, and just as he was going on stage for one of them, I asked Mr. Davidge whether he'd let Billy out yet.
No, I haven't, but I will directly I come off.
And with that, Davidge danced onto the stage, followed by me. The pantomime ended a few minutes afterwards, and we all went home. Well, there was a call the next morning to rehearse a few new scenes, but Pantaloon didn't appear, so there was little that could be gone through with any useful effect. I suppose our victim has taken our conduct in high dudgeon and doesn't mean to come at all this morning, I said.
By God, I never let him out of that box,
cried Davidge, and we dashed to find him. We found the chest in a cellar below the stage. And on raising the lid, our Pantaloon was discovered, rested, contrite, and sober at last. All the jumps, pratfalls, and frenzied pace of the Harlequinade can but take its toll. All those peals of merriment, as cheerful as they sound, have also rung my death knell over many years. At the conclusion of a day's work, I am now completely worn out and exhausted, having taxed my bodily energies far beyond their mortal powers. At 40 years old, my health has started to sink as painful infirmity creeps upon me. I find it hard to struggle through parts, and men are obliged to wait at the side scenes and catch me in their arms as I stagger from the stage while others rub my limbs. You spectators, who convulse with laughter while I'm on the stage, little think that I'm suffering the most excruciating and horrible pains. Those of you who now reap large gains from the exercise of our glittering and dazzling profession should never forget that youth and strength will not last forever. And the more intoxicating your triumphs are now, the more probable is the advent of a time of adversity and decay. There is only a knife edge between clowning and death. Dancing merrily along a tightrope, constantly tripped, bashed and downed, only to rise up as in a pagan mumming play, restored to life to die again. Joey's soul teeters on the brink of an abyss, with the license to fall into oblivion and then bounce back. Sometimes I can no longer differentiate between my clown world and my real world. It is as if the edges of distinction have blurred. One night, I returned home early from my performances at Sadler's Wells, whilst another play continued after mine, but I was rudely awakened from my slumbers around midnight by a great noise in the street and hurried to my front door. The clamouring outside was from friends, who informed me that they had come to assure themselves of my safety, for a most frightful accident had occurred at the theatre during the performance of the later play. Some vagabonds in the pit of the theatre had raised a cry of fire, and as a result, the audience had risen simultaneously to make their escape. A violent rush towards the doors had ensued, with several people flinging themselves from the gallery into the pit. Others suffocated by rushing hopelessly into the densest part of the crowd, and yet more were trodden underfoot. In the confusion, a most fearful loss of life had taken place. I instantly ran off to the theatre, but on arriving found the crowd of people outside so dense as to render approach by the usual path impossible. So I ran to the opposite bank of the New River, plunged in, swam across and found a window open. I threw up the sash and jumped in, a la Harlequin. To my horror, as I stood dripping in the gloom, I saw the still and silent forms of the dead stretched out in the room. Yes, there lay the remains of 9 human beings, lifeless and scarcely cold, whom a few hours back I had excited to shouts of laughter. Twisted and crushed, these poor souls could never leap back to life or take a final bow. The curtain had fallen and extinguished their brief harlequinade of existence. I was paralysed by the sight, unable to move. Just the candle's flicker casting my dancing shadow over the walls. I hurried to the door and hastily sought to rid myself of the dreadful place. But it was locked from without, and as I vainly strove to open it, banging upon it violently and yelling for assistance, the gothic terror of the scene played in my head. I, the clown who'd drawn these innocent moths to my mock flame, was now trapped amongst their still, ghastly bodies. And my father's morbid fears of incarceration rushed back to haunt me. And how I yearned for a magical wand to release some trick or trap and effect a spectacular escape. As my panic grew, the theatre owner's family could hear wailing cries issuing from a room that they imagined to be tenanted only by the dead. They shrank away in fear until at length they recognised the voice and unlocked the door from which their erstwhile clown burst in terror as from a nightmare prison and fled shrieking into the streets. In the end, we must all face the inevitable fact that one day the door will not reopen. Surrounded by the spectres of our past and our shrouded peers, we shall all meet an ending that is seldom spectacular or magical. But whilst we're able, and with God's will, the merry nonsense of life's pantomime should be fun. For life is a game we're bound to play. The wise enjoy it, fools grow sick of it. Losers, we find, have the stakes to pay, that winners may laugh, for that's the trick of it. Aye, that is the trick. To laugh, to play, to live. In the end, there is no more. I don't suppose that young journalist is ever going to arrive. More fool him. He'll hit hard times if he's not careful. Come on then. Hot codlins all round. It's Christmas after all. One more chorus for old Joey's sake. A little old woman her living got by selling codlins hot, hot, hot. And this little woman who codlins sold, though her codlins were hot, she felt herself cold. So to keep herself warm, she thought it no sin to fetch for herself a quartern of
gin.
Oh, for shame! Right on.